Chapter 32. I had indeed a mind to see the city of Pekin, which I had heard so much of, and Father Simon importuned me daily to do it. At length his time of going away being set, and the other missionary who was to go with him being arrived from Macau, it was necessary that we should resolve either to go or not. So I referred it to my partner, and left it wholly to his choice, who at length resolved it in the affirmative, and we prepared for our journey. We set out with very good advantage as to finding the way, for we got leave to travel in the retinue of one of their mandarins, a kind of viceroy or principal magistrate in the province where they reside, and who take great state upon them, traveling with great attendance and great homage from the people, who are sometimes greatly impoverished by them, being obliged to furnish provisions for them and all their attendants in their journeys. I particularly observed in our traveling with his baggage that though we received sufficient provisions both for ourselves and our horses from the country as belonging to the mandarin, yet we were obliged to pay for everything we had after the market price of the country, and the mandarin steward collected it duly from us. Thus our traveling in the retinue of the mandarin, though it was a great act of kindness, was not such a mighty favor to us, but was a great advantage to him, considering there were above 30 other people traveled in the same manner besides us, under the protection of his retinue, for the country furnished all the provisions for nothing to him, and yet he took our money for them. We were 25 days traveling to Pekin, through a country exceeding populous, but I think badly cultivated. The husbandry, the economy, and the way of living miserable, though they boast so much of the industry of the people. I say miserable, if compared with our own, but not so to these poor wretches, who know no other. The pride of the poor people is infinitely great, and exceeded by nothing but their poverty, in some parts, which adds to that which I call their misery, and I must needs think the savages of America live much more happy than the poorer sort of these, because as they have nothing, so they desire nothing, whereas these are proud, and insolent, and in the main are in many parts mere beggars and drudges. Their ostentation is inexpressible. And, if they can, they love to keep multitudes of servants or slaves, which is to the last degree ridiculous, as well as their contempt of all the world but themselves. I must confess I traveled more pleasantly afterwards in the deserts and vast wildernesses of Grand Tartary than here, and yet the roads here are well paved and well kept, and very convenient for travelers. But nothing was more awkward to me than to see such a haughty, imperious, insolent people, in the midst of the grossest simplicity and ignorance. And my friend Father Simon and I used to be very merry upon these occasions, to see their beggarly pride. For example, coming by the house of a country gentleman, as Father Simon called him, about 10 leagues off the city of Nankin, we had first of all the honor to ride with the master of the house about 2 miles. The state he rode in was a perfect Don Quixotism, being a mixture of pomp and poverty. His habit was very proper for a Merry Andrew, being a dirty calico, with hanging sleeves, tassels, and cuts and slashes almost on every side. It covered a taffety vest, so greasy as to testify that his honor must be a most exquisite sloven. His horse was a poor, starved, hobbling creature, and 2 slaves followed him on foot to drive the poor creature along. He had a whip in his hand, and he belabored the beast as fast about the head as his slaves did about the tail, and thus he rode by us, with about 10 or 12 servants. Going from the city to his country seat, about 1/2 league before us. We traveled on gently, but this figure of a gentleman rode away before us, and as we stopped at a village about 1 hour to refresh us, when we came by the country seat of this great man, we saw him in a little place before his door, eating a repast. It was a kind of garden, but he was easy to be seen, and we were given to understand that the more we looked at him the better he would be pleased. He sat under a tree, something like the palmetto, which effectually shaded him over the head, and on the south side, but under the tree was placed a large umbrella, which made that part look well enough. He sat lolling back in a great elbow chair, being a heavy, corpulent man, and had his meat brought him by two women slaves. He had two more, one of whom fed the squire with a spoon, and the other held the dish with one hand, and scraped off what he let fall upon his worship's beard and taffety vest. Leaving the poor wretch to please himself with our looking at him, as if we admired his idle pomp, we pursued our journey. Father Simon had the curiosity to stay to inform himself what dainties the country justice had to feed on in all his state, which he had the honor to taste of, and which was, I think, a mess of boiled rice, with a great piece of garlic in it, and a little bag filled with green pepper, and another plant which they have there, something like our ginger, but smelling like musk, and tasting like mustard. All this was put together, and a small piece of lean mutton boiled in it, and this was his worship's repast. Four or five servants more attended at a distance, who we supposed were to eat of the same after their master. As for our mandarin with whom we travelled, he was respected as a king, surrounded always with his gentlemen, and attended in all his appearances with such pomp, that I saw little of him, but at a distance. I observed that there was not a horse in his retinue, but that our carrier's pack horses in England seemed to me to look much better, though it was hard to judge rightly, for they were so covered with equipage, mantles, trappings, and see that we could scarce see anything but their feet, and their heads as they went along. I was now light-hearted, and all my late trouble and perplexity being over, I had no anxious thoughts about me, which made this journey the pleasanter to me, in which no ill accident attended me, only in passing or fording a small river, my horse fell and made me free of the country, as they call it, that is to say, threw me in. The place was not deep, but it wetted me all over. I mention it, because it spoiled my pocketbook, wherein I had set down the names of several people, and places which I had occasion to remember, and which not taking due care of, the leaves rotted, and the words were never after to be read. At length we arrived at Pekin. I had nobody with me, but the youth whom my nephew had given me to attend me as a servant, and who proved very trusty and diligent. And my partner had nobody with him but one servant, who was a kinsman. As for the Portuguese pilot, he being desirous to see the court, we bore his charges for his company, and for our use of him as an interpreter, for he understood the language of the country, and spoke good French and a little English. Indeed, this old man was most useful to us everywhere, for we had not been above a week at Pekin, when he came laughing. "Ah, Seigneur Inglis," says he, "I have something to tell, will make your heart glad." "My heart glad," says I, "what can that be? I don't know anything in this country can either give me joy or grief to any great degree." "Yes, yes," said the old man, in broken English, "make you glad, me sorry." "Why," said I, "will it make you sorry?" "Because," said he, "you have brought me here 25 days' journey, and will leave me to go back alone. And which way shall I get to my port afterwards? Without a ship, without a horse, without pecune," so he called money, being his broken Latin, of which he had abundance to make us merry with. In short, he told us there was a great caravan of Muscovite and Polish merchants in the city, preparing to set out on their journey by land to Muscovy, within 4 or 5 weeks, and he was sure we would take the opportunity to go with them, and leave him behind, to go back alone. I confess I was greatly surprised with this good news, and had scarce power to speak to him for some time, but at last I said to him, "How do you know this? Are you sure it is true?" "Yes," says he. "I met this morning in the street an old acquaintance of mine, an Armenian, who is among them. He came last from Astrakhan, and was designed to go to Tonquin, where I formerly knew him, but has altered his mind, and is now resolved to go with the caravan to Moscow, and so down the river Volga to Astrakhan." "Well, Seigneur," says I, "do not be uneasy about being left to go back alone. If this be a method for my return to England, it shall be your fault if you go back to Macau at all. We then went to consult together what was to be done, and I asked my partner what he thought of the pilot's news, and whether it would suit with his affairs. He told me he would do just as I would, for he had settled all his affairs so well at Bengal, and left his effects in such good hands, that as we had made a good voyage, if he could invest it in China silks, rod and raw, he would be content to go to England, and then make a voyage back to Bengal by the company's ships. Having resolved upon this, we agreed that, if our Portuguese pilot would go with us, we would bear his charges to Moscow, or to England, if he pleased. Nor, indeed, were we to be esteemed over generous in that either, if we had not rewarded him further, the service he had done us being really worth more than that. For he had not only been a pilot to us at sea, but he had been like a broker for us on shore, and his procuring for us a Japan merchant was some hundreds of pounds in our pockets. So, being willing to gratify him, which was but doing him justice, and very willing also, to have him with us besides, for he was a most necessary man on all occasions, we agreed to give him a quantity of coined gold, which, as I computed it, was worth 175 pounds sterling, between us, and to bear all his charges, both for himself and horse, except only a horse to carry his goods. Having settled this between ourselves, we called him to let him know what we had resolved. I told him he had complained of our being willing to let him go back alone, and I was now about to tell him we designed he should not go back at all. That as we had resolved to go to Europe with the caravan, we were very willing he should go with us, and that we called him to know his mind. He shook his head, and said it was a long journey, and that he had no pecun to carry him thither, or to subsist himself when he came there. We told him we believed it was so, and therefore we had resolved to do something for him that should let him see how sensible we were of the service he had done us, and also how agreeable he was to us. And then I told him what we had resolved to give him here, which he might lay out as we would do our own, and that as for his charges, if he would go with us, we would set him safe on shore, life and casualties excepted, either in Muscovy or England, as he would choose, at our own charge, except only the carriage of his goods. He received the proposal like a man transported, and told us he would go with us over all the whole world, and so we all prepared for our journey. However, as it was with us, so it was with the other merchants. They had many things to do, and instead of being ready in 5 weeks, it was 4 months and some days before all things were got together. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.